It's very heartening to see that somebody very much in the mainstream is also questioning the status quo in many areas. And over the years, Christopher Booker has questioned many parts of the status quo, but particularly to do with man-made global warming. And Christopher's book has caused quite a stir out there, raising the issues that I know many of us here have already considered about, you know, what is really going on here? Even if it is real, is this the best way to tackle it? What is the real evidence? So Christopher has written for many newspapers. He was one of the founders of Private Eye magazine. And indeed. And it's really fantastic to have him here. So please, a round of applause, big one, Christopher Booker.
Thank you, Andy, for that far too kind introduction. When I came in here this morning, I said to myself, wow. I was somehow expecting, forgive me, perhaps 10 people sitting around a table. And I find this fantastic, wonderful audience, lovely to see you all here, superbly organised. And it's always a delight. I live on the Mendips up the hill, and it's always a delight for me to drive down to wonderful Glastonbury. And I was particularly pleased, of course, when I discovered that what this conference is about is alternatives, because, as Andy has referred to, I'm not terribly at home with orthodoxies in this world. I've lived for many years, in fact, probably far too more years than most of you have been alive, with a line from Ibsen's An Enemy of the People, in which the hero, who is hated by everybody, but is right, says, the minority is always right. And he goes on to say, the majority is always wrong. And although there are certain issues, I agree, on which the majority may be sort of vaguely right, there are an awful lot which, when you look into them, you find that the minority, alas, is right, and the majority have got it wrong, because they've believed what they've been told. And what we are told, particularly by the BBC these days, is, alas, too often hopelessly wrong. Anyway, I know what I'm going to be talking about is an issue which inspires very strong emotions. In fact, I can't remember any, or very few in my lifetime, which have divided people off from each other quite so sharply. So I do want to, I don't want to go on too long, because at a certain point I want some of you to be able to possibly disagree with me, or at least make points which will allow would allow us all to have a dialogue in case it gets too one-sided. Now, what I've been, why I've been asked here by Andy, and I'm very grateful for that invitation, and to Marcus for suggesting I should be here, is I published some months ago, in fact last October, a book called The Real Global Warming Disaster. It's got a rather lurid cover. He holds it up. I've borrowed this one, so I can't touch it too often. And over the past 8 months, I'm glad to say, I shyly confess, it has far outsold any other book on global warming in this country for, I hope, at least one simple reason. Because my book tells a story which has not been told before in that way at all, and which, it turns out, a lot of people, like me and myself, I have to say, are quite interested to know how that story has unfolded. Now, we stand today at an extraordinary moment in history. On the one hand, as we all know, for more than 20 years, we've been told that the world faces a quite unprecedented crisis. And the reason for that is that the global temperatures are soaring, and it is all due to the fact that we are pumping out greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. As a result, we are told we are heading for a mighty catastrophe with melting ice caps, rising sea levels, droughts, hurricanes, floods, abnormal weather events. The world's climate system in chaos. Unless we do something or take many, many drastic steps to prevent that catastrophe. And then on the other hand, we have, as we increasingly see these days, all the proposals being put forward by our politicians, not just ours, but those many across the world, to meet this catastrophe in the drastic way it requires. It is now the law of the land in this country, for instance, in the shape of the Climate Change Act, passed 2 years ago, unanimously, almost unanimously by our MPs, that in this country we have to reduce our carbon dioxide emissions, CO2 emissions, by more than 80% in the next 40 years. Now, of course, as you all know, CO2 emissions are part of almost every activity of modern mankind, modern industrial civilization. And it is interesting to note that not one single of one of those MPs who passed that act, let alone anyone else, could actually explain how we could possibly do this without completely transforming our whole way of life in a way that is barely imaginable. So that's the situation we're in today, and that's what, in a sense, my book is about. And forgive me, I'm terribly old and find looking at notes rather difficult, but if you'll allow me to hold them up in a rather awkward way. What my book tries to do is to tell the story of how all this came about, how the fear of global warming began 20 years ago plus, and how it has then unfolded with the politicians getting involved and all the suggestions that have been made as to how we can combat this unprecedented catastrophe. And the story, has unfolded so far through what I see present as three stages, although I have to say that in the last few months, I think we've been moving on possibly into a fourth stage, which I shall touch on at the end of what I say. And the first stage of this story began really not in the 80s, but back in the 70s, when, as some of the older ones among you, like me, will remember, there was much talk of a forthcoming ice age. Now, this is important because the reason why people were beginning to suggest, scientists were beginning to suggest, the media were beginning to get excited about this forthcoming ice age, the reason why they feared such a thing might be happening was that for 30 years, since 1940, when I was a kid, global temperatures had been actually going down. We'd been through a period of quite pronounced cooling. And there was a great excitement about this, and then in the last few years of the 1970s, temperatures started to rise again. And at this point, a number of scientists, and originally not very many, started to surmise that maybe this temperature rise, this new temperature rise, was due, linked to the fact that carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere were also going steadily upwards. Possibly there was a connection between the two. And the blame, therefore, for this possibility that we were heading for temperatures rising steadily into the future, which even then people surmised might cause massive problems for mankind and for the planet and for the climate, the idea that this was happening, it was the first time ever that you could have had such a situation presented where people thought not this is a natural fluctuation of climate, but that mankind and our activities, our greedy, selfish exploitation of the planet in the name of comfort, might be the cause of what was potentially a catastrophic warming of the temperatures. Now, the year when it really all took off was 1988. It was in that year that an obscure little group of scientists in Geneva were given authorization to set up a thing called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change under the auspices of the UN and its World Meteorological Organization and another bureaucratic body, which actually plays quite an important part in this story, although I won't be mentioning it again, called the United Nations Environment Programme. Anyway, 28 guys sat around a table, they were all men, and they set up the IPCC. But at the same time, elsewhere, completely unconnected to what they were doing in Geneva, there was a tremendous excitement, particularly in America, set off in particular by a chap called Dr. Jim Hansen, who worked for NASA, who appeared before a Senate committee, sweated profusely, pointed out that it was probably the hottest day ever in the history of the world, and certainly in 1988 was the hottest year in the history of the world. And he set off a huge, great media hysteria. The media absolutely loved this disaster story, disaster movie story. The environmentalist groups were already getting, like WWF, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, were all also getting, suddenly got very, very excited by this, or distressed by the thought that we were facing this potential catastrophe. Politicians started to move in on it. The first one, of course, who was became famous more through this than anything else was Al Gore in the States, who was sitting in that room when Jim Hansen was sweating away in, on the witness stand. And over in this country, Mrs. Thatcher got very excited by it. Although, as I pointed out in one of my columns recently, she later completely reversed her views. But she, in fact, did set in train a number of things which were to have huge influence on this whole story that we're involved in. One of which was to give large sums of money to the head of the Met Office, a chap called Dr. John Houghton, who's been a very key figure in this story, because not only was he then put in charge of giving the money to start a thing called the Hadley Centre for the for climate studying climate change down in Exeter, but he was also the first chairman of the scientific working groups in the United Nations IPCC, the IPCC, which has played such a hugely important part in this story. In fact, he was in that room in Geneva, which I talked about, and the people that were with him were all already firmly committed to the idea that global warming was happening, that CO2 and other greenhouse gases were the cause of it, i.e. it was man's activity, and they set about writing the first of a series of reports which had been kind of like a holy Bible for the whole orthodoxy of the global warming movement ever since. Now, they relied for their main evidence to support their theory on very complex and expensive computer models. And those computer models, which, as I say, have, with the IPCC itself, have played an absolutely central part in this story, they were essentially programmed to show how, as CO2 levels rose, which they were doing, temperatures must inevitably follow. So, with extraordinary speed, this idea, this terrifying idea, seized the politicians of the world. And the first IPCC report came out in 1990. 2 years later, we had that huge conference called the Rio Summit in Rio de Janeiro, when 20,000 people came from all over the world, including 108 heads of state and heads of government. It was massive. The world had never seen anything like it before. And that led on 5 years later, that was the whole point of the Rio conference, was to set up the framework for the famous Kyoto Protocol of 1997, which was the first international treaty which committed the nations of the world, particularly the developed nations of the world, to cutting their emissions of carbon dioxide. So up to this point, the theory seemed only too plausible. CO2 was rising, temperatures were rising, and everyone in positions of power was having to listen to this, and many of them were beginning to work out what should be our response. So at that point, that's where the first phase of the story, and when you think about it, within less than 10 years, they'd come from virtually nowhere to having this quite unprecedented global treaty. There was just one central drawback which worried the guys in charge of the IPCC, and really there are remarkably few of them. We often get told the IPCC represents a consensus of the world's top 2,500 climate scientists. It's nothing of the kind. Most of the people who write those IPCC reports, most of them actually aren't scientists at all. A lot of them are economists, sociologists, they're even representatives of WWF and Greenpeace. There are a group of scientists right at the heart of the IPCC who have been extraordinarily influential, and one of the places where they are particularly situated is a place called the Climatic Research Unit in East Anglia, which has been in the news a bit lately and which I shall refer to later. However, there was, as I say, one real problem they had with their theory, because it was all very well to say that temperatures going up, CO2 going up, unprecedented, but what were they to do about all the evidence which up to that point had been accepted that at quite a number of times since the emergence of the Earth from the last ice age, about 12,000, 30,000 years ago, there was plenty of evidence to suggest that world temperatures were probably higher than they were in the late 1990s. In fact, for a very long period, the so-called Holocene optimum, for about 3,000 years, they were much higher. And the temperature had climate, as we know. The one thing about climate is it always changes, and temperatures go up and down, and there have been periods of warming, periods of cooling. One of the most interesting ones, which, because it's in a way the most recent example of a warm period, the so-called medieval warm period, was one which took place for 300 or 400 years, about 1,000 years ago. And there was a problem here, because, as you know, in the Middle Ages, when Glastonbury Abbey was being built, there weren't many SUVs going around. People weren't sort of failing to turn off their TV sets at night. And in other words, if the world was warmer for 200 or 300 years in Norman and early medieval times, then what was so new about the fact that temperatures were rising a bit now? In fact, basically what's happened in the last 1,000 years is temperatures were, if I can do it the right way, I'm sorry I haven't got a PowerPoint. It's a real, I know everybody else uses them, but next time I will. The medieval warm period, if the temperature is like that, it then fell for 300 or 400 centuries after that into what's known to climatologists as the Little Ice Age, because temperatures did markedly drop through from about the 13th, 14th century to the beginning of the 19th century. In fact, right at the end of it was when Napoleon's army was freezing to death in Russia. And temperatures were, all the evidence suggests, considerably colder than they have been since, because what happened at the end of the beginning of the 19th century, we began to enter what's known as the modern warming, which has continued ever since. Again, with little ups and downs. I mean, when a lot of you were young, between 1940 and 1975, temperatures fell, having risen quite sharply in the early 20th century, and we went through what is known as the little cooling. Then they started to rise again. That was what led to all those predictions of a new ice age, and then, of course, they started to rise again, and we've seen that going on with fluctuations since that time. Now, the real problem that the scientists who wanted to confirm that they were right, saying that temperatures were unprecedented in the 1990s, the real problem was, how do we get around the medieval warm period? In fact, there was a famous email from one of them saying, "We must get rid of this medieval warm period." And it was a problem, but it was miraculously solved, because in 1998 and 99, a hitherto unknown young physicist in America called Dr. Michael Mann came up with a new graph that rewrote climate history, showing it completely different from anything that everyone had accepted before. What it showed was the medieval warm period had vanished. Temperatures started lower, and they went down slowly for 900 years, and then they suddenly went up like that. It was amazing, but it was just what was wanted. So if you look at the IPCC report for 2001, you will find on the front page, Dr. Mann's hockey stick graph, as it was called. We're talking about ice hockey, of course, not the kind that the rest of us used to play. It's on page one in full colour, and it's five more times throughout the report, reproduced, sometimes up to a half a page. It was the most important single bit of evidence that the guys running IPCC and everyone supporting them outside had yet come across or produced to confirm, as Michael Mann himself put it, that 1998, the year when he did his first graph, was the hottest year of the millennium. So forget about any thought that temperatures had ever been as high as that before. Now, It was this period when, for 10 years, the now completely orthodox accepted global warming theory, CO2 leads to higher temperatures, was really carrying on before it. It was at that time that the politicians, particularly in the European Union and here in Britain, started to pass laws and introduce measures and taxes and so forth that were the first beginning of a response to this threatened massive catastrophe. It was at that time, too, that we got the great passion for building windmills, which, as I think probably quite a few of you now realise, those wind turbines, which are an unbelievably expensive and inefficient and unreliable way to generate energy, electricity, and which would only be built so long as the rest of us threw our electricity bills without knowing we're subsidising them to the tune of 100%. Has any commodity in history been subsidised 100%? Possibly it has, but I haven't come across it. So all these things were going on in the political sphere in the early years of this decade that we've just... Are we still in the first decade? No, we're not. Are we? We've finished that one. So the last decade, i.e. the first years of the 21st century. That was all going on, and the moment I think one can say, looking as I tell the story anyway, when you could say, there's a chapter I've got called The Hysteria Reaches Its Height. And the symbol of that was a certain film, which I suspect some of you have seen, by the great Al Gore, which was an Inconvenient Truth, yeah. Which the centerpiece of which, if you remember seeing it, was his presentation of Dr. Mann's hockey stick. He didn't say it was Dr. Mann's, but it was. And there it showed the line going down for 900 years, and then Mr. Gore had to climb on a little lift to go up because he wanted to make the blade of the hockey stick go even higher than Dr. Mann had put it and the IPCC had reproduced. So this theory was still, at that point, sweeping all before it. But there were just beginning at this time to be rather serious doubts about the methods being used to promote the theory. It turned out, for example, and I've got quite a long passage in my book on this, that if you examine all the claims made in Al Gore's film and his book, you will find that every single one of them, I can't think of a single exception to this, is either an exaggeration, a wild exaggeration, of the established scientific position, or it is flat wrong. And it is quite extraordinary when you go through that film to see just how every time he just nudges it up, or invents. Melting ice caps, droughts, hurricanes, all of the arguments he uses, which, of course, were huge. I mean, he got two Oscars for it. He got the Nobel Prize for Peace Prize for it with the head of the IPCC, Dr. Rajendra Pachauri. Well, the IPCC. But more significantly, some clever people who were outside the orthodox world were beginning to look rather more closely at some of the other aspects of what was being told to us all and put through the IPCC reports. In particular, there's a very, very intelligent Canadian statistician called Steve McIntyre, who I had lunch with a couple of weeks ago, who is a very sober, very meticulous mathematician, statistician. And he, out of curiosity, thought he'd have a look at the famous hockey stick. And what he discovered, he is not a man who shouts or exaggerates. So he has never himself really described the way the rest of us might what he discovered when he worked out how that hockey stick graph had been created. It was a complete fraud. It was based on taking some few bits of data from tree rings in one tiny bit of the United States and then programming the computer to make those feed in more data, but to make sure that every time you put the computer printed out, what it came out with was a hockey stick-shaped graph. And Steve and his colleague Ross McKittrick fed 10,000 times, they fed random noise data into that computer, and every single time except one, it came out with a hockey stick graph. So in other words, it was utterly meaningless. But that was the key bit of evidence, more than any other. Huge quantities of evidence, all those IPCC reports, hundreds, thousands of pages long. But that was the one which had seized everyone's imagination. And so it was that in 2007, we entered a third stage of the story, when in those 12 months of 2007, the global temperatures, as recorded by the main data sources, fell by 0.7 degrees Celsius. Now, you have to be very cautious about temperature trends. You can look at trends, and it depends when you start. The fact is, the crucial point is that that collapse of 0.7 degrees Celsius in 2007, which was equivalent to slightly more than the entire net rise of temperatures shown by the IPCC for the whole of the 20th century. So for the 20th century, it had gone up that much, and suddenly it went down that much. Now, they rose again. So we mustn't attach too much importance to that. The crucial point, though, is that the computer models on which the IPCC relied had not allowed or predicted for such a thing to happen. In fact, there was a general trend for most of the last decade of temperatures going down from that 1998 peak. And the point is that the computer models, which are kind of almost holy objects in this whole debate about climate, people dance around them and believe what they say, and they were programmed to show that as CO2 went up, so global warming would continue, and here it was simply not happening. CO2 was rising, all right. It's continuously risen for the last 50 years. But the temperatures have not followed in the way that models predicted they should. At the same time, more and more distinguished scientists, some very distinguished scientists, some of whom had been involved in the IPCC, some of whom had thought, no, we don't want to take part in that show, were coming out of the woodwork in 2007, 2008 to question very fundamentally the whole thesis on which the global warming orthodoxy rested. What most of them suggested was a much more plausible explanation of what had been happening to climate, not just in the last 20 years, the last 200 years, the last 2,000 years, was fluctuations in the magnetic activity of the sun, for reasons which I won't go into now, but which are actually very interesting because they show that there is a direct relationship between what's happening on the sun and what's happening on Earth, and also, hugely important, the great shifts in the major ocean currents, particularly in the Pacific and the Atlantic, which also have a demonstrable influence and have long been known to have a demonstrable influence on whether the world is warmer or cooler and what is happening to the climate. So you started to get a situation where we began to look at all the evidence which had been produced of this huge catastrophe that was rolling down on us unless we did something drastic. And bit by bit, you could check out each point. The polar ice caps were not melting in the way that had been predicted. The Arctic was a bit of trouble. The Antarctic had been cooling for the previous 30 or 40 years rather than warming, apart from a little bit on the end called the Antarctic Peninsula. So the polar bears weren't drowning. There were actually four times more polar bears, or there are now, than there were 40 years ago. And in recent decades, you think of all the other disasters we've been told that were going to get worse. Hurricanes, droughts, both of them are actually, there are fewer hurricanes, fewer droughts than there were through most of the 20th century, certainly in the 1950s. So we've also, just on a basically weather rather than climate basis, we've all been aware that the last few winters in Britain have been pretty cold, colder than we had got used to. But also around the world. You look at Russia, you look at America, you look at North America, you look at South America. There's a huge, very cold winter going on now in South America. The fact is that the temperatures haven't, as we thought they were doing in the 1990s. We all remember when we had lovely hot summers and we thought, yeah, this is pretty good. And then we were told it was global warming. And now we're getting some really quite severe cold weather. And far colder in other parts of the world than we've had here, although we had some wonderful snow last winter. So the question has been coming forward more and more, is it really correct? The whole of this theory rests on the idea that there is a link between CO2 and temperatures rising, abnormal weather events. Well, you can say we're having abnormal weather events like the poor South Americans are now, because hundreds are dying in right across that continent because there's a huge mass of polar air coming in from the Antarctic. But abnormal weather events are what the climate has always been up to for, not just from millennia, but probably back to the beginning of the Earth 500 million years ago. But at the very time that this was all looking more and more questionable, the politicians, of course, led in this on this side of the Atlantic by the EU and then across the Atlantic by President Obama, who was very keen on global warming, as we know, they were preparing more and more drastic measures to combat this imagined, supposed huge threat. It was, for instance, in October 2008 that all those MPs up in Westminster got together to vote almost unanimously the Climate Change Act, saying that we must all cut our CO2 emissions over the next 40 years by 80% plus. Not one of them, as I say, could explain, begin to explain how this can be done without dismantling almost everything we recognise as modern industrial civilisation. But it was a lovely point, which I remember commenting on in my column that week. It was a lovely, one might think, almost act of God, that at the very moment where the MPs were trooping through the lobbies, 463-3, to vote that absurd act, piece of legislation in, outside in Parliament Square, snow was falling on October the 28th, and it was the first time for 73 years, yes, that snow had fallen in London in October. So God is not mocked, as we are told. Now, the high point of the political dream that we are going to meet this massive crisis on a global scale was the conference that was held in Copenhagen by the UN last December. And what they were hoping to do was to produce a treaty far more drastic than the Kyoto Protocol, which everyone would sign up to. My book was finished in August last year, and it was already clear, for reasons I explained, that that Copenhagen conference was not going to be a success. In fact, it was a complete, utter shambles. And there was a very good reason for this, which was had been apparent for a very long time. As you look around the world today, this wonderful world in which a lot is changing. One of the biggest changes is what's happening out east. China and India, two fastest growing economies in the world, soon be the largest economies in the world. They and a number of other countries, such as Brazil, have been making clear for a very long time that if there is this problem called global warming, it's all to do with CO2, the fault of it lies with the people in the West who started the Industrial Revolution and launched the whole thing, the disaster on its way in the first place. But there is no way that the Chinese and the Indians and their colleagues are going to sign up to a treaty which forbids them trying to catch up with the West, which they're already doing at a considerable rate. In China, for instance, they are still building every 4 days and will be until 2030 under the great 30-year plan. They're still building a coal-fired power station. Every year, they add more electrical generating capacity than all that in France, let alone all that in Britain. In 2007, China became the largest emitter of CO2 in the world, and with all those coal-fired stations, power stations blasting away, they are going to go on blasting, raising CO2 levels up and up and up. There's no way we're going to stop them, because they say, you guys started the problem, but we're going to catch up with you. So the UK is committed to virtually closing down its economy, not that it's going to happen, because eventually the politicians are going to wake up, but we are committed to this completely quixotic, mad thing about reducing our CO2 emissions by 80%. And the UK contributes less than 2% of all CO2 emissions put out by mankind in the world. So what we do is totally irrelevant to what's going to happen overall, And meanwhile, the Chinese and the Indians are just going to carry on absolutely regardless. So these are harsh political realities which force us to think hard about quite where it is our politicians are taking us, and above all, how absolutely reliable can we believe that the science on which all this great huge panic rests, how much actually can we rely on it? And there are certainly a very large number now of distinguished or expert or eminent in their own field scientists who think that the whole thing is scientifically completely off the rails, and that the real reasons for what's been happening to the climate are nothing to do with those that we've been told about by the upholders of the orthodoxy, the IPCC, our politicians, the BBC, pretty well all the mainstream media, and all the other people, and of course a very large number of people in the academic world who for years have been getting large funds. In Britain, it's £100 million over the last 20 years. In the United States, it's $79 billion, according to one estimate. You have not been, if you work in academia, you're not going to get grants if you say, I want to do a project which questions the basis for CO2-induced climate change. But if you want to do a study of, as someone once put it, if you're interested in grey squirrels, and you want to write about, you want to do a little project, you want funding for a project on grey squirrels. If you say, I want to do a project on grey squirrels in Sussex, no one's going to give you a grant. But if you say, I want to do a project on grey squirrels in Sussex with special reference to climate change, the money comes down the trough. So, something very important has happened in the last few months. I've told you about the three stages of the story as I see it. But around the time that Copenhagen conference was ending in shambles, our newspapers were full, or at least some of our newspapers were full, certainly the internet was full, of a whole sequence of really bizarre scandals surrounding the IPCC, which had been revered for years as being unimpeachable authority. And then it turned out that every kind of thing was wrong with the IPCC, who, after all, had regarded the hockey stick as unimpeachable evidence. It turned out that the you remember the climate-gatey emails. Now, what was important about the climate-gatey emails, centred on the Climatic Research Unit in East Anglia, was that the guys who wrote those emails are not just any old two-bit bunch of scientists. They are the key men at the heart of the IPCC. Dr. Michael Mann was one of them. Phil Jones, the head of the CRU, is another. They all link up, or at least the English ones, link up with the Hadley Centre, started by Houghton in 1990, as an engine room of promoting alarm about the climate. So we've got these very committed guys who have been shown by those emails to be incredibly slipshod in the way that they archive their data, who are incredibly rude about anyone who dares to challenge, and to the point of trying to get papers suppressed and even in one case a journal closed down because it challenged their orthodoxy. And above all, it showed them manipulating their data in a way that was very reminiscent of the Mann hockey stick. And that's what we've been paying very large sums of money for, to guys who up to last autumn were treated as if they were the top experts in the world. And what has been revealed and has not in any way been dispelled by these bogus inquiries they've been holding, trying to hold the line on the scandal that was erupted. But that wasn't the only one. There were all the other scandals about the IPCC reports themselves, like Amazon Gate and Africa Gate and Glacier Gate, where it was found that very lurid predictions about disasters that were heading down the track, all the glaciers of the Himalayas melting, the Amazon rainforest, 40% of it going to be destroyed by climate change. It was found that the sources of these were not sound, proper, peer-reviewed scientific papers, but alarmist claims from leaflets and websites run by people like WWF and Greenpeace and the Friends of the Earth, who have benefited. I mean, they have, those bodies, which had some very admirable aims, and I mean, I've been a lifelong, in a sense, environmentalist, and I was very keen on them when they started. But they've been completely hijacked by this whole global warming thing. And, of course, it's been a vast source of funds. How many of you know, for instance, that WWF gets and it has now an income, the World Wildlife Fund, as it used to be called when it was concerned with world wildlife, it has an income now of £400 million a year, of which a very significant chunk comes from taxpayers' money, in the EU in particular, and our own government pays very large sums towards these bodies. Now, it's been estimated that, in the past 20 years, the total amount of money that's been spent on academic research trying to tell us how they think the climate works has run into, certainly well into, hundreds of billions of dollars. Very little of that money, as I say, went towards testing the theory from the bottom. Almost all of it has gone into projects designed to show how global warming was working and why it was going to be such a disaster and what we should do about it. And the result of all this massive expenditure, which, when you think of all the things we could have been spending that money on, including many environmental problems which are very, very serious around the world, all that money has produced is the realization, I think, that we now today know actually less about how the climate works and what's driving it than we thought we did 20 years ago when all this great debate began. But the fact is, we are still left, as the case itself collapses, with what the politicians, who remain absolutely impervious to all these great debates which are going on about the science, they have made up their minds, they're convinced the IPCC is right, we must build tens of thousands of wind turbines, we must raise taxes, we must have carbon trading so that people can buy the right to emit CO2 from the third world or from people who might have made some modest contribution to reducing their emissions. And this is the situation we face, and it is quite extraordinary, and it's far more serious than most people have hoisted on board, because you've now got the two parts of the argument going absolutely opposite directions. And I want to sum up. I'm going to finish now because we must get some questions. I just want to read some words from a guy I spent some time with last month, who is one of the most distinguished atmospheric physicists in the world, Dr. Richard Lindzen of the MIT in America, because this sentence, which I put on the back of my book, really sums up what I believe is the lesson we have to take from everything that's happened so far, better than you could possibly do, than most people could begin to do in one sentence. But Lindzen, as you will see, is quite good at writing. He's almost as good as Neil Kinnock at a very convoluted sentence. Future generations, he writes, will wonder in bemused amazement that the early 21st century's developed world went into hysterical panic over a globally averaged temperature increase of a few tenths of a degree. And on the basis of gross exaggerations of highly uncertain computer projections, combined into implausible chains of inference, proceeded to contemplate a rollback of the industrial age, which is what, basically, we are being asked to do. That's why, after 4 years studying this amazingly complex and very large issue, I subtitled the book, my book, The Real Global Warming Disaster. The subtitle is the obsession with climate change turning out to be the most costly scientific blunder in history? If it does turn out that way, and we are very far from the end of the story, it's something I think we have all got to think about very seriously. Now, however, it is time for some of you, rather belatedly, I meant to finish earlier, but can I have some questions so we can have a bit of dialogue?
Thank you. Well, yes.
Thanks.
If you could wait till the microphone comes to you before you ask a question. We have a lady here, first of all. First question.
I started questioning the science around global warming 2 or 3 years ago, and I soon realised, when I started digging deep, that there was a whole layers of cover-up and misuse of science coming from the official bodies of science. And I realised I was going to have to teach myself the science, which I did. So I've been following your work for a while, and all the things you talk about. And I would just like to add to what you're saying. You mentioned quite a lot of things that people might find strange here and might like to check the facts for themselves. And I actually put a lot of pages on my website. The website is Green World Trust, and there's a whole cache of science pages there where people can check the facts for themselves. And I try to write it in a way that ordinary people coming with no understanding of science could actually start to grasp the science.
Your experience, which is one which so many of us have been through in recent years, as far as I was concerned, and this is true, I know, of a lot of other people, what really attracted my suspicion to the whole thing was when I started to look into the questioning, the expert questioning of things like the hockey stick. And then you started looking at the IPCC and you realise that what we've been told about the IPCC is just completely different from the reality of it. It was always started, it was never there to test whether there was global warming or not. It was started by guys who were already fanatically committed to it, and they've made sure that one after another, their four reports have not just confirmed what they believed all along, but have, on very, very often on very, very dubious evidence, have been hyping it up. So each report has been a bit more alarmist than the last. And that's why we've reached this extraordinary situation where, in the last 3 years, since the last IPCC report came out, and that's been so shot to pieces, that report, all its major alarmist claims have been questioned and shown to come not from proper science, not from proper data-driven science, but from surmises and publicity leaflets and scare stories. And it is really one of the most extraordinary stories in the whole intellectual history of mankind. How could early 21st century, late 20th century mankind, which has for 400 years been replacing religion with science as a way of explaining the world around us, how could that whole huge, wonderful tradition of principle and intellectual rigour, how could it have been hijacked by essentially a comparatively small number of politically motivated people who then got the politicians of the world to believe the distortions that they were purveying? Anyway, I thanks for that contribution, but as I say, I think your experience is that of a lot of people, because we have realised that what we're being told by the newspapers, by the BBC, by the IPCC, etc., simply doesn't stand up to a lot of questioning. That's why we've been doing the questioning, and there are certain heroes of this story. The people who run the big science blogs like Steve McIntyre of Climate Audit, Anthony Watts of What's Up With That in America. These guys, and there are others on this side of the Atlantic, have actually performed an absolutely heroic service to us all, because they are intelligent enough to be able to set out what's wrong with this whole orthodoxy. And most of them have done it for absolutely no reward at all. I mean, there's nothing more utterly disgusting than the claim, which was peddled in the Times again this week, that all these climate sceptics are only sceptics because they are funded by big oil. It's such... If you know these guys and you see how they spend 18 hours a day at their computers on no money at all... I mean, Steve McIntyre's retired, he's got a pension. Anthony Watts still does work as a meteorologist. But my friend Richard North, who runs his blog up in Bradford EU referendum, Richard has no income at all, basically. And that's true of almost all of them. They are doing it because they are driven by true scientific principles. They want science to be based on the data and not on PR.
Thank you. We have another question over here. Hello. I'm curious to know what role the nuclear power industry has had, because if you're looking at pollution and the impact for life and generations to come, that's probably where the biggest danger is.
Yeah, well, I don't want to get involved in an argument about nuclear power. I'll just say very briefly, the reason why we haven't been building nuclear power stations in the West since Three Mile Island and Chernobyl is because, of course, if you look at those environmental groups I mentioned, like Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth, they started as fundamentally as anti-nuclear groups, and then they've moved over to... But what they represent, and I think possibly you represent too, is a great fear of nuclear power, that it is something which actually will end up by polluting the Earth more than even that filthy polluting gas which supplies life to all plants, CO2. However, if we want to keep the lights on, you ain't going to get it through windmills or solar power. If you don't want people to use coal, which is, as we know, fossil fuel carbon intensive, the same is true of gas, although not quite so much. Nuclear power is, as many people believe, but not our present government, in the shape of Chris Huhne, our Energy and Climate Change Minister, nuclear power is the best way to do it. And what the experts will tell you, and I'm sure you won't believe them because you'll say they're all new supporters of the nuclear industry, is that the problems which we've been told about, either of reactors disintegrating like Chernobyl or of the what we do with the waste, these have been virtually solved in terms of huge steps forwards in technology. But I don't want to get involved now. I'm sorry that you and I differ on this, but nuclear power, I believe it's part of the way forward, the only way forward, unless we want the lights to go off. But you don't. And let's just leave it there. That we know that that is a very big difference between different opinions.
I just had a question. I saw a programme a few years ago, and it was talking about global dimming, and it was putting forward that that was part of the reason why the global warming data models weren't correct, because they weren't putting that consideration into place. What do you have to say about that? Have you looked into
this,
that?
Yeah, this has been around for... The idea is that aerosols, little particles thrown up by industrial activity, create a sort of belt across the top of the atmosphere which stops the sunlight coming in. That was being discussed back in the 1970s, when we had that fear of a new ice age, and it was suggested that the cause of temperatures having cooled, because after all, after the war, after World War II, CO2 levels had started to rise dramatically because of all the expansion of economies. So why wasn't the temperature rising along with the CO2 because of global dimming and aerosols? We've got the same problem in the argument about why the Himalayan glaciers are melting, some of them, the wrong book on below Everest and so on. There is a thing called the brown cloud, which is thrown up by all that terrible burning of forests in further south in Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Borneo. A lot of it, of course, is to clear vast areas of rainforests and the homes of orangutans for palm oil plantations to provide biofuels, which then come to Europe to help us prevent global warming. Oh, biofuels. I mean, wind turbines are one thing. Biofuels are so utterly... Talk about self-deception and, indeed, ludicrous expense. And you end up with biofuels actually putting out more CO2 than you save. But the EU says that by 2020, 20% of all our transport fuel must be biofuels. Or is it 10%? 10%, I think.
Do you believe there is an ulterior motive for trying to persuade everybody about global warming, a hidden motive that they don't declare?
I think there are two basic ones. I mean, there are other ones, but the two which I'm most struck by... One is a capitalist motive and the other is a socialist motive, if speaking broadly. There is no question that there are a lot of people who, from, as it were, the left in traditional terms, think it would be a jolly good thing if the rich countries of the world were made to close down large parts of their economies and that they should do much more to help the third world, as we used to call it. And there is definitely a sort of quasi-Marxist element in that side of the debate on why we've all got to take very drastic action against the CO2, which is above all being chucked out, or has been until recently, by the rich, affluent, spoilt West. On the other hand, what is becoming very significant, particularly in the last two or three years, is the way in which there are very powerful and extremely well-funded forces who can see in global warming, particularly in things like carbon credits and indeed in renewable energy, most fantastic financial opportunity. And if you look at the people who are involved in this, I mean, you are looking at the people who rule this world. The City of London is the centre of cashing in on the global warming scam, as one might call it. And I had a piece which I was not allowed to put in the Sunday Telegraph tomorrow, showing how the Murdoch Empire is absolutely right in this, particularly with the William J. Clinton Foundation, which is going to be the biggest organiser and arranger of financing for solar parks, carbon trading, and making money out of the carbon dioxide locked up in rainforests. And that's something I've written about several times recently. It is an amazing scam. And who's at the heart of it? WWF, that supposedly idealistic environmental group, and a little group that works alongside it called the Woods Hole Research Centre. They have estimated that if they can get a mechanism, which they almost got in Copenhagen last year and could get at the end of this year under a thing called RED, which is a UN-backed scheme and the World Bank's behind it, they could turn the carbon dioxide locked up in those trees in the Amazon into $60 billion of carbon credits, which would be sold to Western firms to allow them to go on polluting, as they call it, putting out CO2, in return for buying carbon credits. The whole thing is such a racket. Generations yet unborn will look back on this as one of the greatest acts of collective lunacy in the whole history of mankind. I thought that was it. Yeah. Sorry I went on rather longer with the...
You've been fantastic. Ladies and gentlemen, Christopher Booker. Great stuff.
Audience, and I've got news for you. There's still daylight outside, so go and enjoy it.
Thank you. In fact, you have 10 minutes of daylight if you would like.